Hi, and welcome along to Early Excellence's Head to Head podcast. It's great to have you here. I'm Sarah Carey, School Improvement Lead here at Early Excellence, and in these podcasts, I'll be connecting with real head teachers and school leaders. We'll be discussing hot topics in primary and early years education and sharing some real experiences. So keep listening to hear more about school inspections and impactful school improvement strategies. Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining me for this month's Head to Head podcast. As always, I hope everybody is well. And today I'm really delighted to be talking with Catherine Mole, MBE, who is the CEO of Dingley's Promise. Hi, Catherine. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Thank you so, so much for taking the time to talk to me today, because I know you're extremely busy. Your schedule keeps you very busy, out and about doing lots of really important and high profile work for the charity, and I'm really, really looking forward to hearing much more about all of that today. So thank you so much. Now, time is precious and we want to dig into the meaty stuff, so let's jump straight in and hear a little bit about you, your background, your role, all of those sorts of things, just to set the scene.
Right, background wise, okay, so I have always been involved in disability since I was about 8, and started volunteering when I was about, I think, 13 with children with disabilities, and it's always just been a part of my life. I think I've always had a really strong feeling about equity and fairness, and for some reason it was always disability that was the area that made me sort of think, well, that's really not fair, and why aren't people included, and why isn't everyone together? And from a really young age I sort of felt that way, and I think, God, when I was about 13, no, younger, when I was about 10, I would say to my parents, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to Asia, because at that point I was obsessed with Asia, and I'm going to set up an organization. I'm going to make sure that children are not in orphanages in Asia for having disabilities, but they're with their families, because that's what's right. And they're like, okay, dear, whatever, lovely. And then it just kept going. And sort of I got to sort of 15, 16, and I was starting to apply to VSO. You can't apply for at that age. It's not allowed. And they're still looking to be going, oh my word, do you think she's actually going to do this? So yeah, on my 18th birthday I flew out of England to go and work for a year in Sri Lanka as in a home for children with disabilities, and it, yeah, incredible year, really an incredible year of my life, on top of a hill in the middle of nowhere, which was like an hour's walk from the nearest bus stop, no electricity, no running water. It was like full-on intense.
Yeah, a show experience then, and probably kind of life-shaping in many respects.
Yeah, because the reason it was so remote was because nobody wanted to have the disabled children around them. So the charity that supported disabled children, they got donated a piece of land, which was miles away from anyone else, because that's sort of how they preferred it. So it was, again, it was a really big lesson in what is inclusion and what is exclusion, like really, really extreme exclusion. In that organization, I went back a few years later and did some work with them on sort of looking at inclusion, looking at how they could help those children remain connected with their communities. And they weren't very happy with what I'd said around inclusion. And then about 2 months later, there were all these family members milling around. And I was like, what's going on? Who are all these people? Why have they turned up? And then one of the staff said, like, don't tell management. But when you said we should be trying to keep contact with the families, they sent postcards out to the families. So they told me they don't want to know. They're never going to come. They sent postcards out. And so over 50 of the families had all turned up after those postcards were sent. But they didn't want to tell me because they were like, oh, we don't want you to be right. But yeah, anyway. Then I worked in Thailand, doing research on children with disabilities and, you know, aspects around culture and how that impacted on how they were treated. And then I worked in Vietnam as an English teacher for a couple of years. And then finally came back to the UK in 2011, when I got a job with MenCap, a local MenCap. And so I ran that local MenCap for a little bit. And then in 2015, I got my role at Dingley's Promise as the CEO of Dingley's Promise. And that's where, you know, the organization, I think, changed significantly, because when I joined, it was sort of three settings that were specialist settings, much more around that traditional model of hold the children, hold the families, and then move them into special education once you've finished with them. And of course, I came from a background of inclusion and felt slightly uncomfortable with that. And then, you know, and also heard, you know, one of the local authorities we worked with sort of said to me, oh, yeah, you know, Dingley, you're where we dump the children that we know are never going to be able to get to the mainstream. You know, and that was the word that was used. And I remember just thinking, oh, my word, something needs to change here. So we in 2015 released a statement on inclusion and what inclusion meant to us and how we believe specialist early intervention builds inclusion. It's not an alternative to inclusion. And then at that point, I think about 35% of our children left us to go to the mainstream. And after the work that we did over about 5 years, it sort of then settled at around 70% of the children who leave us go to the mainstream. So it's massively, massively changed. And obviously the organization now is growing really fast. And as opposed to three little nurseries, it's now 10 nurseries. We're going up to 12 by January. And we have about 28,000 learners on our inclusion training across England, all from mainstream settings. And as you said, we also lobby and do all of that as well. So I love it, because it's great working for charities, but you know when you're in a charity where you've actually got something unique and you've actually really got that ability to change things. And I think certain other charities you might work in, there's lots of other people doing the same thing. Whereas this, the reason we grew so fast and the reason we're having the influence is because there was a massive gap, a huge gap. There's lots of organizations that do early years. There's lots of organizations that do SEND and disability, but there wasn't an organization in the middle that did early years SEND. And that's where we've landed.
Yeah. And that's perfect. Because I was just about to say, because there'll be some people listening who know a lot about Dingley's Promise. There'll be some that have perhaps heard things or maybe seen on social media, but there will be some people thinking, what is that and what's it all about? So you've just kind of talked about what it is in terms of and the nurture and the growth, but if you could describe really eloquently, I suppose, somebody who said, you know what, I've never come across this charity before, what's its purpose, what does it do, tell me, how would you describe it to somebody brand new?
So what I would say is, I mean, so Dingley's Promise is called Dingley's Promise because of the promise that we make to families, which is to give their children the best start, regardless of whether that's in mainstream or whether that's in special education. Every child deserves the opportunity to get the best start for them. And then the second meaning of the word promise is that we see the promise in children as well, because I think that for a lot of our families, they've had messages of your child will never do X, isn't going to be able to do this, can't ever do that, and it's very, very deficit based and negative. And we are very much about building that celebratory approach to each child, each individual child, to, you know, what they're going to achieve in their lives. And so, you know, we do work really strongly in partnership with families and really, really working to sort of build their hope for the future and, you know, obviously their knowledge about how to support their children, but also just that belief that the system can work for them and that it's supporting them through into that system as well. With the children themselves, it's about, again, really understanding each individual child, what works for them, how can they thrive, what does thriving look like for each individual child? It's not imposing what thriving is. And then also, I think the other really exciting part is that working with the next setting and making sure they not just have the knowledge, but also have the confidence to work with children with SEND and support them inclusively. And I think that wider view of what is inclusion, that's become really key to everything that we do, to sort of say, well, actually, you know, good inclusive practice is about, you know, every practitioner, every educator in every setting, really understanding this is how I include every child. It's not just about training for a Senko. It's not just about, you know, a child having an adult sort of latched onto them to move them through the day. It's really about that full inclusive whole team approach. And I just, and I think when I see sort of clips of educators in, you know, across the country sort of going, yeah, you know, it's amazing. It's a movement for inclusion. We're making things better for children. Like, I hear that and I literally you know, I get emotional for sure, because it's like, God, like 10 years ago, who'd have thought we could create a movement? And it does feel like there's a really strong movement towards inclusive practice in the early years now.
Yeah, it's so powerful. I think it's really poignant how you talk about the word promise in the charity's title. I think that's really really poignant in terms of that commitment to the families and that commitment to the children, because actually every child deserves the very best, don't they? And the kind of the support and opportunities to enable them to flourish, however that looks for them and their individual journey, I think is so powerful. But seeing the promise in them as well, is that, you know, I think that really resonates. And you're quite right, some of the things you've just talked about, it is about really high quality practice for early years. It is about understanding those individual unique children. And of course we know the statutory framework and things talk about that, but actually it is digging into it in you know, these are little children with real personalities, with real things to bring, real next steps in their journey to undertake, and they are part of a bigger picture of their family, and they have a place in their family, in the community, in this world. And I think it's so important. And you're talking about all educators. As you say, it's not just about the adult who perhaps spends the most amount of time with that child. Everybody who's engaging in, you know, it's the whole team around the child, isn't it, to understand those children, but also understand what effective practice looks like and how that will work really well for that child. So yes, EPD and putting it into practice, and yes, that really shared understanding, but that real commitment, and you use the word confidence as well, and I think that is something, again, making sure that the whole staff team are confident and the families are confident in what the schools and settings are doing for their children, confident to ask the right questions, confident to share their opinions and share how things are going, what works for them, and confident as well to be able to say, you know what, it's really hard and I'm not sure what to do about this. Actually, it's about those relationships, isn't it? And again, we talk so much in the early years about positive relationships with young children, and that absolutely stands, but the importance of positive relationships with parents and carers and key significant people in those children's lives, and the key people who are actually going to be not just supporting those children on a day-to-day basis in however that looks, but also the adults who are championing for those children. I think it's really, really important as well. So yeah, I know there's lots of kind of wonderful things that you do, and we're going to talk a little bit more about kind of how you do support settings and such like. But I know, I mean, I was fortunate enough to hear you speak at an event, and I heard kind of came from meandered over, and we had quite a conversation about people in our lives and various other things. And then I thought, maybe at some point we could have a podcast. But I think when you were talking to the group, what came across really strongly is absolutely, and you can already feel from our conversation so far, you're so passionate and you have such a belief and such values around what you're doing. But you also kind of are really committed to making change where you can, and doing that kind of national picture and that kind of lobbying, and you're really working to influence change and those sorts of things. So it'd be great to hear a little bit more about all of that work that you're doing and how it's going. And yeah, I'm sure there'll be bumps in the road, but I know you're so committed to it. So how
is it going? It can be exhausting, but I think what's really exciting is that right now the landscape is that early years SEND is on the agenda. And 2 years ago, it wasn't. It just wasn't. And so when you look at new policies and what the government is talking about, I think when the new government came in was probably quite a big change moment, regardless of what party they are, it doesn't matter. But when they came in, one of the first things they talked about was how critical early years was, and second breath, Bridget Phillipson, second breath, how important SEND was. And we all sat there and went, oh, they've literally just said early years and SEND as the two most important things. So, you know, there was hope immediately. And I think that when you look at things like the Best Start in Life strategy, and you look at what is outlined in there, it's really, really clear that SEND is streamlined into the Best Start in Life strategy. There's lots of consideration of SEND, which is something that we weren't seeing before. It was always an afterthought. that's not to say there are not policies where I have concerns. And I certainly think that, you know, part of the best start in life was the announcement, well, was more detail on the school-based nurseries. Mm-hmm. And we do have some concerns about the difference between really strong SEND practice and really strong inclusive practice and what those differences are. And when you look at really strong SEND practice, and often maintained nurseries have really strong SEND practice, you know, identifying need, getting specialists to come in and work with those children, and, you know, going for diagnosis, getting EHCPs in place quickly so when they move into school, those are there. Now, that is obviously necessary in some cases, but what we see in the PVI sector is sort of what we're hearing from local authorities is the strong inclusive practice is actually stronger there. And so I think what we're really looking at is how we can support maintained nurseries and school-based nurseries to have more access to inclusion training, so that is really, really strong in school-based nurseries as well. Because of course, when you're in a school-based nursery, and I was talking to a leader of one of the school-based nurseries the other day, and she was saying to me, well, you look at the good level of development and the government's target, and she sort of said, you know, we're getting pressure now from the leader of the school that all the children coming in have to meet those GLD targets. And she's saying, and I've got children with SEND who I know are not going to meet them. And so I'm being encouraged potentially not to take those children. So I think there are aspects of being linked to a school that can potentially be damaging to inclusion. So I think it is about, you know, making sure that we support those school-based settings on really, really strong inclusive practice, because they're growing, because the government's investing, and then there's going to be more and more school-based settings. So yeah, I think that's something that's been something we focus on. I think we were really over the moon to see the new funding stream for early years, which will come in, we think, in April 2026. And we've been working with the Department for Education on what that's going to look like. And I think where, you know, it's great to see more investment in inclusion. I think where there's probably still a gap that we're trying to look at the moment, but that is definitely going to change, because the early years SEND funding is going to change in the future. And DfE are working really, really hard on that at the moment. But what we've been talking to them about is how we need to make sure that there is funding for children with high needs in the early years that is not just dependent on the HCP, because we keep hearing from people saying, look, you know, either the children with higher needs are absorbing all the SENIF funding, which should be for low and emerging needs. Yeah. And then therefore there's less early intervention, or they just can't access the funding they need until they get an EHCP. So what we need to be doing is making sure that funding, so we get in as quickly as possible for children with higher needs, is available regardless of whether you have your diagnosis, your EHCP or not, because those things take time and we need to get in as soon as possible.
It's happening in real time for those children, those families as well, isn't it? And I think you're absolutely right. Early identification is crucial, as is kind of early intervention in terms of, and I'm not talking actually, let's take these little children out somewhere and really make them sit at a table and do something. I'm talking about those high quality adult interactions, those engagements, those opportunities for the children to explore and have their needs met within, as you say, part of that very inclusive practice. But again, we know money is tight in the education arena. There's no which way around it, but actually it's still happening in real time, and staff are working really hard. Staff across schools and settings are working really hard to make the difference. However, things that does need to be changed, isn't there, in terms of we can only do so much with the situations that we're in. And what you're talking about sounds, you know, really promising if things roll through. And like you say, you're very, very kind of engaged with the DfE. You're very much heavily involved in lots of those conversations, lots of the working groups and the such like. So I know you're well placed to kind of have your finger on the pulse with those sorts of things for sure.
We work on it hard. And I think that partly there's a, you know, when I speak to educators, they just sort of say to me, well, actually, why don't they value the early years for the impact it makes on children with SEND? Because actually the early years, all the research shows the early years make the biggest impact on life outcomes. And then you see the high needs block funding for schools, which should also be given in early years. And some local authorities don't give any high needs block funding to the early years. And you sort of think, well, are we saying children under five don't have high needs? Because they do, you know, and it's sort of, I think there's a part of it that ties into the valuing of the early years and how much are we respected. And yes, of course, schools are 100% statutory, but actually early years is also statutory in its own way. It's not that children have to go, but local authorities have to have enough provision for children with SEND. That is a statutory demand. And so, you know, I think sometimes people just think it's less important. And I think there is something around valuing the enormous impact that a good early education has on all children, but especially on children with SEND. And I don't think we're there yet. I think that's what we're still fighting for.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, in terms of the research, if we take SEND out for a moment, the research around the impact of the first, you know, 1,000 days, the impact of high quality early years. If you think of the EPSI project and the EPI project and all those longitudinal studies, the impact of high quality early years, high quality adult interactions, high quality early experiences. So we're not just talking about schools and settings and preschools and child mind. It's actually early childhood experiences, parents being the first educators, all of that can make a significant difference to the children in their here and now journey, but they're also their onward success. And of course, that is also true for those children with SEND as well. And I think, you know, we know that the spotlight is coming more and more on early years, and I think that is a good thing. Obviously, that along with that, there can be additional pressures, let's just say. But I think when we, you know, this new inspection framework that's out there now in the toolkit, we know inclusion is clearly sitting within the toolkit, but is woven through every element. So again, you can feel that this is the kind of the spotlight and the status of it is changing, but equally, it's, as you say, it's the bigger picture around the policies and such like that are going to enable the parents, carers, providers, whoever they are, to really kind of support those children as best they can. Because, you know, just by changing, just by saying we're going to look more at inclusion doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to get better, because actually there's still the CPD, there's still the opportunities, there's still needing the right high quality staff, they're still actually having the right learning environments, the right spaces, the right opportunities to help those children. That doesn't just come just because suddenly there's a spotlight being placed on it. It's so much more about that embedded practice and provision and kind of all those kind of expectations, isn't it, for sure? So I know, obviously, again, as part of your work, you engage in quite a lot of research as well, don't you? So it'd be good to hear a little bit about that, if that's okay.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got some exciting pieces of research at the moment. So up until now, actually, our research, we've pretty much done ourselves. So we've sent out surveys and we gather the surveys and then we feed those percentages back into the national conversation. But at the moment, we're in sort of a stage of switching into getting other organizations who specialize in research to do research on our behalf. Mm-hmm. So we've got a piece of research that's live at the moment that should be out before Christmas on what is the cost of inclusion. So actually, you know, saying to be a strong inclusive setting, how much should that actually cost? So that is really interesting. Obviously, it's useful for the government because they need to look at what they are budgeting for inclusion. But at the same time, you know, we've done quite a lot of work with settings as well, focused on actually how many children with SEND should you be expecting, and therefore how many should you be business planning for? Because actually, you know, there are lots of funding streams. They need to know those funding streams well, and they need to be using those to say, actually, we can access this, access that, and this is how much it will probably cost us if a child is, you know, accessing our service, but under a graduated approach, sort of an ordinarily available provision level, how much should we expect that to cost us? And then if they're going to be accessing Cenif, you know, how much would that cost? I think those kind of things are really important, because otherwise it's almost like a child turns up and people go, oh, a child's here. Oh, how are we going to fund that? And you really, really want to have had those thoughts and that planning before they arrive.
Yeah, it's because it's about being proactive rather than reactive, because we know the picture of send, you know, it's higher now, isn't it, in terms of, when we're talking to settings, when we're talking to schools, they're talking about higher numbers of children with need coming through. And equally, higher levels of children with higher level need, but equally, there's still the other echelons of children with lower level need that perhaps do need specific intervention, targeted support around kind of language and communication and speech and language, or other things that early intervention and early identification is still there as well. And I think actually, if we know that is a growing picture, which it is, it is about planning for it, and that absolutely makes sense. And yes, you know, you're talking about settings, and I would include school-based nurseries within that, and you've just touched on those, because it's the government's, it is the government's drive. We're engaging with lots of schools that are expanding, be that kind of going, already having a nursery, but actually increasing their numbers, or maybe opening two-year-old provision. We've had the odd few where actually, you know, because it's 9 months on from 9 months on now, we've had a few schools that we're working with for that. But again, we're having conversations around, you know, these aren't little, they're not just littler nursery children or littler reception children.
It's a different sector.
It's a completely different ball game. Child development and understanding child development is crucial. And it's crucial for leaders, whether you're a PVI setting and you're a nursery manager, whether you're a school-based nursery and you are the early years lead as part of that, or the school leader as part of that and the school leadership team, understanding what's happening in the two-year-old provision is vitally important. And again, it's knowing that picture and kind of planning ahead. It's about strategic planning, isn't it? And kind of, like you said, business planning for that is really, it sounds kind of obvious, but I don't know that it's in that sort of way. So I think it's a really when you good talked point about, to raise.
Yeah, when you talked about being proactive, I think everybody gets, oh, be proactive about training. Everybody gets that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we all want to be trained before children arrive. We know what to do. We reassure the families. Brilliant. But when you talk about business planning as a part of being proactive, sometimes that really, really is a tumbleweed moment of like, oh, I don't know about that. Oh, you know, people aren't as comfortable with that at all. And we have one of our courses is on leadership of inclusion. And actually, we didn't think it was going to be that popular, because obviously there's few leaders compared to the number of educators. Like, we just thought it's going to be a little course, and it's been one of our most popular courses. And I think it's because often those things aren't really discussed. It's just sort of inclusion around, you know, what does the SENCO need to do? What are the processes? How do you get the HCPs? How do you get the diagnosis? Like, what's the system? But actually, there's not much talk around, but how do you lead this? How do you embed it in your team? How do you ensure you're having the right conversations with the other professionals? How do you ensure that your curriculum is inclusive in the way that, like, there's a lot bigger, and of course that includes how do you business plan for inclusion, which ties into another piece of research that's also going on at the moment, which is around what percentage of children have SEND in the early years in every local authority area in England. So that's really useful, because what we'll do is we can then feed that in, and it's helpful around settings saying, oh, in our area it's about 10%. Right, we need to be assuming we're going to have 10% children with SEND. Or it's important for a local authority to go and look at a setting and you know, they may be supporting a setting and say, oh my word, you've got 32% children with SEND, and we know in the area it's about 10%. What can we do to help you? Or vice versa, they've got 2% children with SEND and they think that's normal, and you say, hang on, actually normal is about 10%. How can we help you to welcome more children with SEND? So, you know, and it really ties into that sufficiency conversation for local authorities about do they have enough places for children with SEND? And at the moment, the childcare sufficiency assessments do not document well how much they have for children with SEND, because legally, we're supposed to say any child, regardless of whether they have SEND, is welcomed into a setting. Now, I get that. And of course, that's what we all want. However, when you're business planning, that's not very useful because it's because all they do in the CSAs is say, yeah, okay, so we've got this many places, we have this many children, regardless of if they have SEND, they should be accepted everywhere, and therefore we don't have a problem. So we've been doing work on talking about what is supply and demand for children with SEND. So how many children with SEND are you expecting in your area? And then how many places do you actually have? Like when you talk to a 20-place setting, if they had 20 children with SEND who needed those places, would they be able to give them? No, they wouldn't. They wouldn't be able to manage that effectively. They will have a number that they sort of go, that's probably where we would sit. And so you kind of need to know those numbers, even though, of course, you have to accept every child that comes to your setting. But you need to have that discussion because otherwise no one knows what availability there is. And that, so at the moment, latest research we had was that 29% of families had been turned away from a setting because their child had SEND. So, I mean, that's like a third of families. So you do start to think that's a major issue. And it has risen recently because, of course, each time we get more early years entitlement, the children who get less access are children with SEND. And obviously, we all know it's just jumped massively. So, so it all ties in. It all ties in. I've gone through the research and all the other bits as well.
Yeah, is that that research in particular, I think, would be really insightful and actually is needed, as you say. And of course, you know, when you're talking about business planning, just to kind of circle back to that, because we're talking about kind of structural. As you're talking about, if you like, structural leadership as well as kind of pedagogical leadership. And that structural leadership is about, you know, the space. It is about the staffing ratios. It is about kind of having the right ratios and having the right qualifications. And again, sometimes we talk about in our training, you know, they are conversations to be had. And you've just touched on this. They're conversations to be had. We've got to have those conversations. Just because it says in the statutory documentation, we only need a qualification at this level. That's the floor of it. We only need, but actually if we can look and source higher, you know, and if we had the magic wand to button over all of that, actually we could have higher qualifications. What impact will that have for all of our children? Equally ratios. We know the ratios. That is our must. But if we can make those ratios even smaller in terms of average children, again, that's going to have an impact. So it's whilst you don't necessarily have all of the answers, it is part of that kind of business planning. I think that's really, really important. So I know obviously you're really keen to kind of support practitioners and teachers and leaders who have got nurseries and PBIs and such like. So in terms of, you know, you've got almost a bit of an open platform here because this goes out to, you know, across the UK and internationally. So what are the key messages that you would like to kind of get across? Because obviously one of them you've just touched on in terms of that business planning, but other things that you know are important that perhaps are not as prevalent in people's minds, maybe, or things that you know you're talking about a lot, you know, what would be those key messages, do you think?
I think at the moment, there's a lot around inclusive mindset, and what really links into inclusive mindset is the celebratory approach. And there was a document that came out from Penn Green quite some time ago now, which is really useful. I think it was interesting. I was in a conference recently and did a workshop around working with parents, because obviously working with parents is absolutely critical. And I think in our sector, we're often, you know, we are the most trusted professionals for parents of children with SEND. And all the research shows that, you know, we are the more trusted than the medical professionals and the local authority staff. We are the people they turn to. And I sometimes get nervous when I hear particular language or ways of phrasing things that are quite deficit based. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a level of understanding language and the way that we talk about children with SEND that we really do have to be really careful about, because actually they do trust us as families. And when we are celebratory about their children, when we talk about the potential and possibilities and, you know, what can happen in the future, that is what molds how they feel about their child. And I mean, I've seen a lot of reports where it's like, this child refuses to do this, this child won't do that. It's sort of like, well, if they're, you know, refusing to do a certain thing that you want them to do, what do they like doing? And actually, can we celebrate the bits that they do enjoy doing rather than go into sort of like negative stereotypes about, basically about different sort of diagnoses? Because there's that sort of imposition of what we think is okay and what we think needs to change in a child. And there's a lot at the moment, a lot of great people, Kerry Murphy and Cheryl Warren, doing a lot of work around neurodiversity and that real strong celebratory approach and how we support children. And I think that has to be something that people think about very carefully. And every time I have those conversations, on the day I heard people say, oh, the normal children, as opposed to the children with SEND. You know, I know, my face did that too. Yeah. And just that sort of, it's almost like people think it's about vocabulary when you talk about language. It's actually, yes, of course, there is some vocabulary you wouldn't use anymore. However, it's more than that. It's actually about the reason why people are saying what they say. And it's really challenging what is written in reports, especially like, do settings have people who are checking in on those reports and sort of saying, actually, the way it's written, I'll be comfortable with that, because that report will be seen by other professionals, but it will probably also be seen by the parents. And so what you're writing in there has a massive effect on them. So I think that's one really, really important aspect. And as I've mentioned parents as well, it's really how much are we doing that ensures that parents of children with SEND not just have us to support them and to work with their child and obviously to do all the great things that we do, but recognizing they're at home with them 100% of the time. What strategies can we give them that they can maybe use at home? But also, what other support systems are there for them? And do we know those support systems? And obviously, in a busy mainstream setting, you can't know everybody. You can't do everything. And I often say to settings, just have an A4 sheet with all the local connections on, and just to be able to say to any member of staff, you can hand that over to that family if you want to and tell them there's resources there. And if they, you know, if they're not sure about something, we can support them in contacting them. Because, you know, mainstream settings are busy, busy places. And I think, you know, I come from specialist settings where we have more time and we have a whole family support program. You know, I mean, there's a lot more resource. But I think for those mainstream settings, it's what are the connections? And again, this is where leadership comes in. Where are the connections that we know that we can signpost families to and also that we can work with? You know, the new family hubs, and in every family hub has to have one staff member who's going to specialize in supporting families with children with SEND. You know, do we know who they are? Have we found that out? Can we use them as a way to support families and link them in even further? And I think that's our responsibility as early years settings. We can't solve everything. We can't do everything, but we can be aware of what there is to support families.
And I think you're so right. And in both of those instances, what you're talking about actually is the kind of the settings or the school's kind of culture and vision and values. So when you're talking about communicating the language that you're using, actually, that should be our common practice when we're talking about children, you know, and because we do spend time when we get those all important breaks, if we get those lunch breaks or whatever, which I know are few and far between, and sometimes we're food hoovering at that time. Yeah. But actually, how we talk about children, any children, it's important, the language that we're using and how we view behavior, because all the behaviors is the children telling us things, how they're responding, what they're telling us. And again, there are certainly conversations around that now, that's more widely understood. But I think when you're talking to parents about children, when the children themselves, they can hear some of those conversations. And again, it's about that self identity and that self-esteem and how as a family they can have those positives as well, because it's hard work if you've got a child with need, you know, very much loved, but it can be really challenging. So having that celebratory approach is key, and that's part of a bigger school picture, isn't it, in terms of how you approach things. And in terms of what you're talking about signposting, you know, lots of schools and settings will know where the local food bank is, for example, and which charities people can go to and where they can get kind of help. all we're talking about is expanding that to, and what about how we're supporting our families with need? And actually that doesn't just come back to the school and settings, Genko, to have those conversations. We all have a role in that. And I think the best starting life family hubs are obviously being rolled out, and there's still previously there are already kind of hubs and things in place. But I think just to be really reiterate something that you've said, do you as a school or setting know where they are in your local area? Because we talk about that a lot. My colleague Fizz, who does the national briefings all the time, says, do you know where it is? Because sometimes it can be a stone's throw and you don't know. And they're there. They're tapped into. And there's a huge push on them. You know, it's part of the government's initiative, The Best Start in Life. And I know there's some really, really wonderful things happening. And actually for families to be with other families and have that time together, I think is so, so important. So again, you're looking at that bigger picture, aren't you, in terms of making sure that as you say, inclusion, and it's threading through everything that you do, and it should be. Yeah. It really, really should be.
So can I add a few more? Sorry. So training, what I have to say about training as well, because that is a huge barrier, and lots of educators say there needs to be better training and training that is practical. Again, not about just the systems, but actually about what do you do in a room with a child when, you know, you need to maybe deliver a graduated approach and you're thinking, what strategies do I have in my toolbox, you know? So I'm going to say there's lots and lots of training through Dingley's Promise, and in lots of areas it's free. So please, if anybody needs inclusion training, check with your local Stronger Practice Hub, because quite a lot of the Stronger Practice Hubs have access to our training for free. They can also go onto our website and then put in their local area and see if it's available for free. So while it's free, grab it. I know in 32 areas, it's only going to be free until the end of June 2026. So all I would say is get in now and get that for free. Because I think as we said before, what's really interesting is, yes, of course, it's knowledge, but it is also confidence, to the point that I've had people say to me, oh, actually, when I finished, like there's an introductory course. When I finished the introductory course, the biggest impact on me was that actually I knew quite a lot of it, but I just didn't trust myself. And I wasn't sure if I thought the right thing. And now I'm going in with massive amounts of confidence and I'm going to go and do it. And so it's, you know, it's not rocket science. It's not. And often people will have had little bits of training or knowledge from different places. And often there's brilliant practice that they know, but they're just not 100% confident it's the right thing. So sometimes it can literally be that. So even people who've had many years experience, it's almost that moment of going, this bit is right and that bit's right. And of course, there'll be some new bits added, but that's also really important. It's not just about...
And I think it's that trusted voice as well. Obviously, Dingley's Promise has a huge amount of expertise, a huge amount of research within it. And I think, you know, we similarly find, what, you know, when people want to talk about SEND, they want a trusted voice. And we have a kind of an SEND associate who goes into schools, mainstream schools, specialist provision schools, to offer that very practical, you know, on the ground as it's happening, you know, the child is in the place that they're in and it's all happening. And again, as you say, sometimes it is that reassuring. That's a really good start point. But it's coming from somebody who, a team of people who are, you know, steeped in experience and research and can, you know, be saying, and we don't have a magic wand, but actually we do have lots of understanding. You've done lots and lots of things to help kind of set that scene and build that picture. And I mean, I agree. I mean, CPD, I think, you know, you will know early excellence offer lots of training, and not, yes, we do SEND stuff, we do lots of other things around over the years in Key Stage 1, but we also know that CPD is an area that's not as well invested in as it perhaps needs to be. It's the first thing to go, really, in terms of tight budgets and those sorts of things, because in addition to costs, obviously the supply costs, cover costs, all of that sort of thing as well. However, the staff with the children are with the children, they're the tools of the trade, aren't they? Investing in high quality CCD over time, and not just doing it as one-offs, but actually, again, back to how that's approached the school and the setting. So we've been on this training, what have we learned? What are we going to try? How's it going? What's next? Yeah. All of that bigger implementation picture is really, really key. So yeah, I would absolutely agree with you, CPD, vital. Anything else on your list?
Yes, and the last one is just around the Department for Education's Early Years Assessment Guidance, which is a really, really useful document for early identification and early intervention. And again, it's celebratory in nature. It's not linear. It doesn't say a child has to do this first and then they do this. So it is a document that can be really useful to support educators to really feel in control of identifying needs and then supporting that child. So I wanted to flag that as well, because it's certainly something local authorities are looking at in more detail. Some of them have already implemented it in their local areas, and more probably will in the future. And I think the more that we can have standard documentation in early years that schools recognize, that if you move local authority area, it's the same document, you know, the more we can get of that. And I know that when the white paper comes in, things are going to change significantly, but I think that at that point, when the white paper comes in from the Department for Education, I do believe there will be more focus on more standardization, because I think where schools are expecting a certain document, then actually at times of transition, it's much more likely they're going to take that information seriously and value it and say, oh, the earlier setting did exactly what we needed, which at the moment is pretty rocky, I would say, and we need that to improve.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really good. Obviously, you've mentioned the Penn Green document and you've mentioned that document. And I think it's really important to kind of signpost those sorts of things, because sometimes they can get missed or lost in the ferrari of everything else.
And that's so much.
What you're saying is that as a specific document is really, really helpful in terms of the kind of how it's looking at assessment and how it's looking at the children. And as you say, not linear. And, you know, I'm sure there'll be lots of things that listeners will take away from today. And there'll probably have been lots of nodding and at moments as well, which is what I've done as science. But I think, you know, those documents will be kind of really, really important. Are there any others kind of on your radar that you would signpost in terms of documentation? Is there anything else that might not be, just on that note? Because I know people do like to, that's something I can go and do.
The other thing to definitely look at is the Childcare Works site and the Childcare Works hub, which is the area for settings. So on there is loads of stuff. We've created a lot for them. So there are like short videos, bite-sized videos, lots of different topics. On there, we've just released an inclusion reflection tool. So settings can use it and then they can reflect on how inclusive they are, what they might want to do. It's had brilliant feedback in when it's been trialed. So it's big, and you wouldn't do the whole thing at the same time, do you? No, absolutely not. But it's really good at encouraging settings to think about, oh, that's something I haven't considered before. Do we do that? We don't. Would we like to? Let's look at it. So that's really useful. There's also guidance coming out on creating an inclusive curriculum and that difference between send and inclusion, and how we can really make sure that inclusion is really strong, not just the send systems. So there's a lot of resources on there, and they also have a whole section on leadership of inclusion with videos and information. So it's a little treasure trove. So I would definitely say get onto there if you can.
So that's a little nugget. So I feel like we've perhaps given listeners a little bit of homework. So we've said to them there's a couple of documents, that website to visit, and also kind of finding out where your best start family hub is and kind of what they've got to access.
Absolutely.
And those sorts of things. So that's kind of, I suppose, in some respects, actionable things. We're sorry to go on to-do lists, and we know they're never ending, but they are things, you know, lots of people do like to kind of explore those sorts of things in their own time.
For settings to find their ordinarily available provision document for the early years. Now, some areas don't have one. Some areas have one for like the whole age group, which is not as good as having an early year specific one. But some areas now do have early year specific ordinarily available provision documents, and it just outlines what every setting should be offering as standard. So it's helpful to settings. It helps you with planning your provision, but it also helps you with, you might be wanting to apply for some some funding, but if it's something in the OAP, you're going to waste your time applying for funding because they're going to say, actually, that's ordinarily available. So no, we're not going to fund it. So it also reduces potentially applications that would waste your time. So I think they need to know it and they need to share it with their families so that families know, you know, my child is not a burden. They're not extra resource, extra this. All of that is standard. That should be offered to my child as standard. And that's really reassuring for a parent.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that great. Really, really helpful. So you, I think it's been great to hear this. There's such a lot that you're doing as a charity. And as you say, looking at kind of influencing that national policy and looking at that research, I think is so vital because that the impact of that will potentially be really widespread across the country. But actually then you've also been able to give some really specific examples of things to be thinking about, whether you were, as you say, setting or school-based nursery. I think that's really, really powerful. So kind of you've left us with things to go away and explore. But what's next for Dingley's Promise? Anything on the horizon that you're absolutely really excited about?
I'm very excited that we've got a book that's coming out. So Routledge approached us to create a book on early years inclusive practice. So that will be published early next year. So I'm very excited about that because that feels like there's a little manual which anybody can get their hands on. That's very cool. And then, I mean, from the point of view of our sort of lobbying, the white paper will come out in January, and that's going to be a huge time. And what the government will ask for is for people to feed back on that and tell them if they think it works or not. And I think we're just really excited that it's about the whole school system, but it is very much centering early years. That's what we've been promised, that it will center the early years. And I think that's probably the first time that there's going to be a huge send strategy where early years is considered a key foundation. So I think that's really exciting, and I'm really, really, well, I shouldn't say that, I'm excited to see it, and I hope it's all going to be positive. Let's say that.
Absolutely. Wow, great. Well, thank you so much for your time today. As I say, I mean, I feel like we could talk for hours. There's such a lot that you're doing and throughout. I mean, you are, as I said at the start, you know you're really passionate about what you do. You really do see that big picture and see where you sit within bridging the gap, as it were, early years and inclusion, as the supporting families, settings and that kind of transitions through, I think is so powerful. And you've smiled all the way through, and it's powerful in terms of what you're doing. So thank you so much for everything that you are doing, because it is, as you say, it's making a difference, and you can feel, and I know that schools and settings are feeling that movement is happening, and that's testament to your hard work and that of your team as well. So well done, and thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks for joining us today. I hope you found it a valuable listen and that you've taken some things away to reflect on, or maybe things that you want to discuss with your colleagues. Of course, remember, if you want to talk about any of the issues that we've explored today, or you need support with other matters in your school, then do feel free to drop me an email, sarah@earlyexcellence.com, or why not get connected with me on LinkedIn or Twitter. Anyway, take care and join me next time for some more genuine head-to-head conversation.